Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the program. Between now and nine, finding life's meaning in the ocean waves off Sligo, reclaiming farmland from the ravages of war in Ukraine, finding paths to the next generation, and pronking in the Wicklow Hills. It is not a made-up word, I promise you. Pronking is the way that deer spring into the air as they take flight. I get to see pronking every Saturday morning on my way in here before the programme, because at that time of the morning there are Sika deer everywhere on the roads. The population has exploded in the last few years. So back in 2022, the government appointed a strategy group and just this week awarded a management contract to a co-op to set up 15 local deer management units around the country. Deer densities in counties Wicklow, Tipperary, Waterford, Donegal and Galway are above sustainable and are impacting not just on farming and forestry, but they're also having a bad effect on nature conservation and on biodiversity. Now, the idea of a deer cull is obviously emotive to some, and they will argue that nature should be left to take its course. So, this week, I got a range of opinions about what the cost of that would be.
Why did you plant native broadleaf?
It's an investment in nature and biodiversity. You're talking about these oak trees. Should it be 100 years before they reach any maturity?
Since planting 30,000 native broadleafs, oak, alder, beech, holly, 7 years ago, Chris Maloney has seen Wicklow's Sika deer do their best to undermine his efforts at nature restoration.
And at what stage do you think that they won't be vulnerable to the deer anymore?
I'd say 10 to 15 with some of the species.
So you really have to mollycoddle and be very precious with them.
They're like rearing children.
Except you've got 30,000 of them.
From that wood over there, you could see 60, 70 deer approaching. The stalkers have told me they've counted up to 90 to 100 in packs.
And how many were you seeing trapped inside your plantation fence?
At the start of the forestry, there was probably about 30. We got them down to about 5. And the jigs and the reels, over 2 years, it took us to eliminate them. Didn't totally eliminate them because...
There's new ones coming in.
There's new ones coming in.
How many trees did you lose?
4,000 approximately.
Were you expecting that level of loss?
I had no idea what I was getting into. You can see the 6-foot fence that was originally put in.
Solid, well built. Wire is still taut. 6 foot wasn't enough, was it?
In places it wasn't good enough where they could get a run at it. So they had to come back and go to 8 foot.
The open field behind them has a downhill run, so they were able to take a running lap at it.
A running lap at it and successfully cleared it.
6 feet.
So they had to carry on 8 foot from there, nearly all around the 30 acres. They either decided to go over it or burrow under it. The little prickets kept popping at it, popping at it, popping at it, till they eventually forged their way through.
And there were places deer just throw themselves at the fence.
Absolutely, yeah. They'll just keep at it and at it till they get to where they want to go to.
Anybody who thinks that you just plant the trees, put up a fence and walk away is in for a bit of a rude shock.
Not going to happen. Not going to happen. Not going to happen.
Jane Stout is a professor of botany in Trinity College. We went to look at a 10-acre unfenced patch of native woodland that the deer are free to roam through as they please.
So there's no sheep have access to this little spot. What's your first impression?
First impression, we've got a lot of young trees in here. But they're all of a very similar age stage.
And they're all birch, which, as we know, would grow on Mars.
Yeah. So very little diversity in terms of the species, very little diversity in terms of the age, and very little ground cover. So we're not seeing the ground flora that you'd expect. Like I say, hard to say at this time of year when things are only just starting to pop through anyway. That must be a bit of
wild garlic,
isn't it? Yeah.
Which would also grow on Mars in
abundance. Absolutely. But there's little diversity here. So when you've got a high pressure of grazers like the sika deer, then they do take out the ground flora.
And when you look down, if we hunker down here, you can see that these little bits of lichen moss have actually been grazed.
Yeah, ends have been taken off. So, you know, they'll be grazing on the stuff that's coming out of the ground, the soft, sweet, young shoots. So for the trees, in terms of any regeneration of the trees, they'll graze the seedlings because they'll be easier to eat. They're less heavily defended than an older tree. So that's where you don't get the regeneration of the trees, but also they're taking out the ground flora. I don't know what the palatability is of the wild garlic, but it may be that they avoid that, and so you end up with this reduction in diversity. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with invasive grazers like the sika deer is if they graze out all the stuff that's tasty and leave the stuff that's not tasty, and that becomes a problem when the stuff that's not tasty is also non-native. So that's when you get problems with things like rhododendron. So they'll graze out everything else and leave the rhododendron seedlings because they're not tasty.
Oh dear, are you okay?
Slippy
because there isn't actually that much vegetation holding the ground together.
Yes, I just discovered that.
So does that mean that an area like this is more prone to soil erosion and that soil ending up in the river precisely because there isn't that much vegetation down
under our feet? So when there's lots of vegetation in the ground and all the roots are holding the soil together, that's when vegetation can help to prevent soil erosion. So if you lose your vegetation, you lose those rooting structures that are holding the soil together, and that's when the soil washes away.
And it helps keep scientists on their feet.
It keeps me on my toes.
What's the longest you've ever waited? Or is it more usual to go home empty-handed?
You could be just as easy going home empty-handed. It's absolutely a lottery in some respects.
Ed Hick is a deer stalker. He shoots for the pot. Up until now, population management has been left in the main to people like Ed. And it is a long and a labour-intensive process that can't keep abreast of the birth rate.
How long, how many man-hours does it take Ed Hick to take one deer down off the hills?
In real terms, I think you could probably think about a day and a half.
For one?
For one. That's processing, that's taking it home, that's cutting it up, that's preparing it for the freezer.
So several hours of a stalk, grollicking it on the side of the hill, carrying it back down to your car.
Yeah, all of that sort of stuff. And all of that has to take place, if you like, in your free time.
And how many amateur stalkers or hunters are there in the country?
Well, there are 6,500 licences issued each year. Last year, I think the numbers were, there was 78,000 deer taken. So that would be on average 10 per person.
And how much further north of 78,000 does that number need to be to get the population under control?
I think nobody has any idea, Philip, which is the key point here.
We don't know how many there are.
So for you, I, or anybody else to say we need to reduce the population by 20%, what does that mean? We don't know what the population is. For us to say, what we do know is that they will multiply by approximately 30% per year if they're left on their own.
This particular landowner has given permission for people to shoot deer on his land.
Yeah.
But neighbouring landowners might not. How big a problem is it that the deer can just run away, jump over a hedge and sit there sticking their tongue out at you?
The reality of it is, however diligent this particular landowner's programme is, if his next door neighbour has no programme in place, that's where the deer are going to go. They'll go where it's safe. And they'll come out and eat where they come out and eat. So it's really how much pressure they feel under and how much threat they feel under is going to determine where they are.
So there will be no effective population control unless a quantum who knows what that number is, but the majority of landowners in an area say, yes, you can come and shoot on my land.
Pretty much, because otherwise all the deer will just go onto that one particular patch of land and come out from there every evening.
What do you say to the people who have an ethical problem with shooting any of these animals at all and say, we should just allow nature to take its course?
I think the reality of it is, if you look at areas, for example, up above Glendalough in the National Park, the herd sizes up there are staggering. That's them effectively being left alone. What does that do for biodiversity? They just eat pretty much everything, like, to be honest with you. If it grows, they'll eat it.
What reassurance can you then offer to the people who have their reservations about this whole process that it is done humanely?
Well, licences are issued in Ireland is the first thing. So, you know, there are people, obviously, who take matters into their own hands. But the licensed hunters, the people who are licensed by the Parks and Wildlife, there are hunter competent assessment programs. So there is training, there is education involved. Recognising deer and deer behaviour that people have to do, there's an exam, you know.
And where an animal ends up being wounded and not taken down with the first shot, do you guys commit yourselves to finding that animal and making sure that it doesn't suffer?
Well, any responsible shooter would, yeah, they'd have to. Anybody who's gone to the trouble of going through the not insignificant hoops of getting a licence in Ireland, they're committed, you know, they're keen on it. They want the best.
Ed Hick, one of the part-time stalkers on whose back previous deer population control strategies were built, but clearly relying on their efforts is no longer enough, which is why a working group was formed 2 years ago. And arising from their recommendations, the government has just awarded a tender to the Co-op Farm Relief Services to set up 15 deer management groups around the country to control the population on a more full-time basis. The chairman of the working group is Teddy Cashman, who joins us this morning with one eye being cast over a busy calving shed. Can you take your eye off the shed for 5 minutes, Teddy? Everything going okay?
Yeah, well, we just got the calving camera fixed this minute, and I can see it now from where I am in the office, but the eye needs to be kept on things on an ongoing basis now. Things are pretty hectic for the last 3 weeks, I suppose.
All right, so if you end up sounding a bit distracted in this interview, we'll understand why.
No, there's nothing imminent, don't worry.
Ed Hick was saying there that no one really has any idea of the size of the population. How big a surprise was that to you when you started your work?
I suppose, yeah, when I started 2 years ago, I asked for what a national figure was, and they said it was 600,000 deer, plus or minus 200,000 that time. And that was the best guesstimate they could do. And, you know, that's an irrelevant figure. When you have that percentage up and down on a figure, it is meaningless, really.
So if we don't know how many there are, Teddy, how on earth would anybody ever be able to decide what is the right number to shoot each year?
I suppose you have to start very much on the whole idea of impacts and what impacts are happening in an area. And you spoke about the biodiversity in places there a few minutes ago. And where there's a serious biodiversity impact, you know that you're going to have to go into that area and be more enhanced in your efforts than you would be in an area where there's less impacts. The same scenario where you have lots of road accidents and persistent road accidents in an area, you know that your populations are out of control there also. The other thing is that, you know, drone technology and infrared drone technology is being developed quite, is probably the future here, really, I suppose, Philip. And in local areas and in local deer management units, that it's an option to be able to get some handle on the numbers. Mm. But that technology is only coming to fruition now, but it is up and active and it is a possibility.
And if you put the drones up at night and you use thermal infrared, yeah, you get to see them when they have come out of the forest and come out of the covers. We also heard there, talking to Ed, how unless all of the landowners in an area get on board, the deer are just going to be able to evade the scope of the hunter's rifle. How would you encourage enough people to allow shooting on their land to make the difference that you need to make?
I suppose deer management units are very much about collaboration. They won't work otherwise. So each unit is a collaboration between the hunters, the farmers, the foresters, all those impacted by deer in a particular area. So there's going to need to be quite a lot of public engagement with people in a local area, that people understand what's happening and are very clear on what the issues are. And if people know what's happening and they know who's doing what and they know what the targets are and what the outcome is, the perceived outcome or the desired outcome is going to be, you have a much better chance of getting people on board. And we have engaged with all of the farming organisations, all of the hunting organisations, the foresters, anybody in ecology who wants to take part is also welcome. So they can, you know, that it's a collaboration is the only way this is going to work. But for that, people need to have good information on the ground. They need to know who's doing what. And they need to be part of the process.
And do you think
that there are outsiders coming into their area?
Do you think that at the moment the best strategy is to persuade rather than to compel?
Oh, I think you don't have any other option, really, to be honest, Philip. It's a persuasion scenario.
Okay.
And look, you know, human nature being as it is, you will have pockets where it won't happen to the extent you want it to, but you're going to have to do your very best to have an overall positive outcome. But there will be work in engagement on that.
In order not to be wasteful, it seems kind of obvious that we should try and develop a venison market off the back of increased hunting. But did you find that is something that is easier said than done?
For sure. I suppose there's a couple of issues around the venison one. It's not probably a meat that's widely eaten in Ireland, and where it is eaten, it's generally eaten in a restaurant setting. And there hasn't been a great culture of eating venison. So, I mean, we have engaged with Bord Bia as part of the subcommittee process around this, and they have been involved in the venison subcommittee here with us as well. And it is something that will be a slow burner, but will need to be engaged with. But you're going to end up, you know, moving venison to various different options if you're going to get rid of the amount that you're going to need to do if you're going to do an enhanced management program around deer.
I understand, though, that the issue at the moment is that the huge amount of labour involved in getting one deer off the side of a hill is not really rewarded by the price that is paid for it.
Absolutely, yeah. And prices at this time of the year tend to fall once you come into the spring. And venison, for the last number of years, has been selling around €2 a kilo in the first half of the season and has dropped in a lot of places about 150 at the moment, which hunters find uneconomic once you get into February and March.
Now, I have absolutely no doubt that the RTE switchboard is already lighting up with the people who are horrified listening to this at the thought of the taxpayer funding a cull of any wild animals. What would you say to them?
Well, I would say to them, I suppose you need balance in society. What we're hoping to do here is to get to a sustainable level of deer population. You're not trying to take out the deer out of the wild. What you're trying to do is to maintain a population at a level that is sustainable. And I've often cited the scenario around Phoenix Park. People are well aware that there is a herd of deer in Phoenix Park, but they are managed every year to make sure the numbers stay at a certain level. And everybody gets to enjoy the wildlife in Phoenix Park on that basis because they're not allowed to grow out of control. So there is no natural predator. So what you need to do is get levels to the deer numbers to an acceptable level where biodiversity can flourish. Forestry can regenerate and deer will have enough to eat generally. At the moment, in some places, the deer are being impacted by a lack of nutrition because of a lack of, you know, there are too many in an area and there isn't enough for them to eat.
Teddy Cashman, back to the calving with you, and thank you very much for your time and thoughts this morning.
Thank you very much.
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
You heard in the headlines a half an hour ago, how the Taoiseach is participating later on today with his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky, in a discussion on food security at the Munich Security Conference. If indeed this war is in the beginning of the end stages, it raises the question about how much damage has been done to the rich agricultural land and soils on the battlefield, and if, when and how these lands can be returned to farming. Dr. Olena Melnik is an associate professor at the University of Sumy in Ukraine. She has been studying precisely these questions. When I talked to her earlier on, I asked her to remind me first of how much of the world Ukraine had fed with its sunflower oil, its wheat and its barley.
Ukraine was the first exporter of sunflower oil, more than 50% of all the export, the third exporter of corn, barley, rapeseed, and the fifth exporter of wheat. Even despite the war, in 2024, Ukraine entered the top 10 world producers of fruit and vegetable products, and approximately 400 million people worldwide relies on Ukrainian food export.
That is an impressive achievement, really, when you consider everything that has been going on. How much land has been lost or has been damaged by the war, Alina?
About 139,000 square kilometers. It's kind of equivalent to the size of an average European country. And about 109,000 square kilometers remain occupied, making farming impossible in many areas.
Describe to me what kind of damage has been done. What has happened to the land?
Since the beginning of the war, Russia has launched over 15,000 drones, 10,000 missiles, 40 million artillery shots, and most of them have ended up in the soil. So the number of craters in our land has already reached more than several tens of millions.
It's not just the loss of equipment and the creation of craters across the landscape, though. It's also the heavy metals that are left behind. What has that done to the soil?
We have analyzed during the last 2 years about 3,000 soil samples from potentially contaminated regions. Some of our research samples revealed really elevated concentrations of chemical elements such as sulfur, tin, cadmium, copper, iron. However, in the majority of soil samples, heavy metals were detected at acceptable levels, or with only minor excesses. Our findings have supported more optimistic forecasts, indicating that with proper management and remediation, much of the soil could remain suitable for agriculture and food production. And I want to stress also that we focused on craters, trenches, and demined areas. But unfortunately, we still encountered some hot spots where military technique was burnt or oil spilled, and concentration of potentially toxic trace elements on such areas is much higher.
And Alina, are those hotspots lost to farming forever, or can the soil be rehabilitated in any way?
We suppose that such areas can be rehabilitated. Of course, it will take quite a long, because, for example, to remediate 1 centimeters of soil, sometimes it's necessary. It takes up to 100 years. But we suppose, and our government set up quite ambitious goal to return unsafe territories to productive use by 2033. And according to our approximate investigation, it will cost up to 50 billion.
What does that involve? Do you literally remove the topsoil and replace it with new topsoil, or what do you do?
No, we prefer more unnatural methods of remediation, for example, heat remediation, bioremediation, different types of less harmful cultivation, like low-till, non-till.
So as a percentage of the total of agricultural land, how much is currently unfarmable and how much would you aim to have back in cultivation within 8 years, by 2033?
Approximately one-third territory of Ukraine, for now deemed as potentially unsafe due to miners, due to unexploded ordnances, and maybe some a level of pollution, and we hope to get back up to 80% of these territories by 2033.
Are you optimistic for the future and for the future of farming food production in Ukraine?
Yeah, of course I'm optimistic, because we have no other chance like just to be optimistic. Because Ukraine, before the war started, was an important venue that we could historically rely on. Agriculture made up to 12% of our GDP, and about 14% of our population was involved, was employed in agriculture. That is why we will do our best as a scientist and to support our agriculture, to develop the rapid remediation techniques and to test soil to understand how we should proceed with soil remediation and revitalization of our such important natural resource.
Dr. Olena Melnick there with that very ambitious 2033 target, which is, when you consider the amounts of Flanders and the Somme in Belgium that are still unfarmable after the First World War, indeed a very, very ambitious target. The future of farming is about many things. Yes, obviously, as we were just hearing, it's about the health of the land, but also about the farmer themselves. We might not be aware of this, but the conversation in this country about the difficulties of finding the next generation of farmers is one that is actually happening right the way across Europe, not just here. There are more older farmers, fewer younger farmers, and an anxiety about generational renewal. Who will be farming the land in the next generation? Dr. Emma Dillon is a senior researcher at Chagask, and she joins me now from our Athlone studio. Good morning to you, Emma.
Good morning, Philip.
The urgency around this issue comes from the age profile of Irish farmers. Can you remind us, please, of what the numbers are there right now?
Yeah, so I suppose just to say that the Irish figures are in line with the EU average, but there are some countries who have a younger age structure. So in Ireland, one third of farmers are aged over 65, and the average farmer age, according to the National Farm Survey, is 58. So there are some differences there across farm systems, with dairy farmers tending to be younger and having younger household members. I suppose a startling figure from the National Farm Survey in recent years is that 3 in 4 farmers have been the main farm operator for more than 20 years. And I suppose this is reflective of the ageing labour force more generally, but certainly it is an issue.
And I think it's 5% under the age of 35, isn't it? And the difference between now and 30 years ago is that, you know, back then farming was a very, very attractive, perhaps the most attractive option if you were lucky enough to be born onto a farm. But there are so many more attractive options for people off the farm today.
Certainly. I think it's true to say that there are opportunities in the wider economy that weren't there previously. They have improved dramatically, and there is more potential to earn a relatively high income compared to some farm systems. And also the fact that people tend to stay in education longer, and this delays them entering the workforce, and then as a consequence, perhaps delays them taking over a farm.
I think one of the very interesting things about your research, your and Jason Lockery's research, is the different picture within each of the sectors. Can you break it down for me, please, and tell us what's happening on dairy farms, on sheep farms, and dry stock farms?
So within the National Farm Survey, we have asked the question in recent years about whether or not a farmer has identified a successor. And on average, 6 in 10 farmers have done that. But it does differ across farm systems, as you say. And I suppose the recent paper highlights the nuanced nature of farm succession, and that it's not just about economic performance, but we also need to take account of the social factors. So one of the key findings that's getting some attention is the fact that viability was not a key driver on cattle farms. And that is to say, when the farmer was asked if there was a successor in place, those operating less viable farm systems were more likely to have a successor, likely on a part-time basis. Now, there are two caveats around that. They were asked their opinion as to whether or not they had identified a successor, but there was no formal agreement in place. So we'll need to revisit to see, did that actually happen? And I should also say that viability should be a key objective of our agricultural policy, and that we need to strive to improve viability. And finally, the year the data was collected was a particularly challenging year in terms of farm incomes, so there was a higher proportion of farms deemed unviable. But it's true to say that there are different factors at play across other systems. And in terms of potential succession on dairy farms, issues around work-life balance and stress and the presence of young people in the household were key factors. So some viable dairy farms had not identified a successor. So it is quite a nuanced situation.
OK, but on the whole, had the dairy farms got this as well sorted out as those smaller suckler farms in the west of the country?
They were generally in line, and I would say that we see more evidence of farm partnerships and younger people being involved on dairy farms. because it's a viable career option to support a farm family on a more full-time basis, they tend to be more commercially orientated on average. And so we see on dairy farms younger people providing labour. And you were talking to the dairy farmer there a few moments ago, particularly at, you know, busy times of the year with that seasonal workload.
So where are the problems arising then? By a process of elimination, that suggests that it's the larger dry stock farms or sheep farms that haven't got succession plans in place.
I suppose it's true to say that there is a delay around succession on some of those farms. And a lot of those farms potentially will be continued on a part-time basis. And Chagask engages with graduates. And in a recent survey looking back at graduates who graduated 5 years ago, 90% of those graduates are still involved in farming, but an increasing proportion on a part-time basis. And interestingly, we asked the question around whether or not the move to remote working would facilitate succession on farms. And it was on the smaller farms that that seemed more likely. Mm. So it's a very complex pattern and a very complex picture with differences around family dynamics and family tradition, and the fact that some potential successors are well established in well-paying jobs away from the farm.
We spoke to two farmers farming in partnership very recently, an arrangement that had been set up through Land Mobility Services. And one of the things that really struck me about it was that the energy and the dynamism of a young progressive farmer coming into a big farm meant that that farm was entirely abreast, indeed ahead of all of the environmental regulations, and it was an absolute, you know, poster pin-up of a farm in that respect. Is there a danger where you don't have succession plans worked out that there's a tranche or a cohort of farms that might fall behind in that respect?
Certainly research from across Europe would indicate that younger farmers display a better willingness to take on new technologies and adapt to the changing policy environment, and particularly around environmental sustainability. But it is difficult to generalise. What I would say is that with the presence of a young person there, there is some foresight around the future, the continuation of the farm, and some optimism there. And also the opportunity to invest more heavily on the farm due to the presence of, you know, grant aid through TAMS or the different incentives that are there to facilitate young people entering farming. And also, if younger people are involved on the farm at an earlier stage, it makes diversification options potentially more feasible and more likely. So this whole model of farm partnerships is a very good one in terms of sharing the knowledge and ensuring the continuation and productivity and viability of those farms.
How big a stumbling block to proper farm succession is our inability to start this conversation within families?
Certainly, it's a difficult conversation to have, and it's not surprising that it is a conversation that is somewhat delayed and, you know, postponed. But I think that if farmers are considering this, and if it's a source of concern to them, that they should start the discussion, be that with some of their family or their peers, and that there are lots of supports and advice available to them through Chagask and through other organisations. And it's fair to say that these conversations are being had at kitchen tables all around the country. And we see that with the number of people who are engaging with the Transferring the Family Farm clinics that Chagask run every year. Close to 1,300 people attended those last autumn. So it's a difficult decision, but there is guidance there and lots of opportunities mm-hmm. in terms of incentives for the young person and also for the farmer who potentially would like to exit.
And I don't want to end on I don't like to end on a negative here, but it is important to consider this. What happens if we don't get this right?
I think it is a challenge, but I think it's really positive that we're discussing it. And, you know, the Irish CAP strategic plan has numerous measures there to support young farmers, taxation reliefs, access to finance. And certainly there is scope to improve the incentive for the older farmer who would like to exit. And the Department of Agriculture have recently established a commission on the matter, of which I am part. And we are currently examining the evidence, and we're grateful to all those stakeholders who have submitted information mm-hmm. through the public consultation. So I think we're informing ourselves with the evidence, and we will hopefully come up with some new options around the future.
And what is the timeline on the delivery or the presentation of those options? How soon do you expect us to be able to cast an eye over them?
Well, we're working to a June deadline, so hopefully our report will be ready then, Philip.
All right. Thank you very much, Emma Dillon. Emma Dillon, Senior Researcher at Chagask, joining us there from our Athlone studio. Alice Ward is a surfer and a filmmaker based in Sligo. Her first film, Ebb and Flow, profiled a trio of highly skilled female surfers on the northwest coast of Ireland. Now she has turned the camera on herself, though, and with cinematographer Xiao Tudela has made an award-winning film called Salt. It tells her own story about living life with cystic fibrosis and her relationship with the ocean, which has sustained her since early childhood. Lorna Siggins met Alice at high tide at the Atlantic surfing mecca of Strandhill.
From a very young age, I've been messing around rock pools, and my dad is a long distance sea swimmer, so I did my first sea swim when I was 12, or no, maybe I think it was 8. He just threw me into, I think, a kilometer sea swim, maybe it was probably a bit less. Yeah, just hopped in, no wetsuit. I was with a load of teenage boys, so I just wanted to show them up, I think. Yeah, it was great fun. We just were always doing fun things like that. My dad always still says that wetsuits are for wimps. I've always loved cold water, and I think that's why I love living here out in Sligo, because there's loads of cold water, so I know how to deal with it. I like the way it makes me feel, and makes me feel very great when I get out of the ocean.
Are these really good surfing conditions or medium surfing conditions?
For me, lovely surfing conditions on a longboard. They're kind of easy, small enough waves, so could be a relaxing session.
That's obviously, is that a class out there or?
No,
they...
that's just the locals out right. Waiting for waves.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the
yeah.
peak. Okay. So I started surfing when I was 14 on a family holiday in Dunfanaghy up in Donegal, and then I became hooked, so I spent every summer in Dunfanaghy learning how to surf, and I worked at the Rusty Oven, which is a pizzeria up there, which my great friends run. I was thinking about the film pitch, and I was wondering how I was gonna make it, maybe focus it on not so much cystic fibrosis, but focus it on a different thread, and then I started thinking about salt, and it's been a very present theme throughout my life. But basically, cystic fibrosis is caused by the movement of salt and water in between cells. Yet people with cystic fibrosis have unusually salty skin. So that's what my mother first noticed when I was born, was how salty my skin was. And then one of the nebulizers I take twice a day is saline, which is salt. And then in my own personal life, I surf, and I'm a surf filmmaker, so I spend so much time in the ocean, which is also salt. So it was kind of this perfectly circular theme that presented itself to me for the film.
Your mum, Mary, wasn't taken seriously in the beginning.
Yeah, when I was born, I was very, very ill for 6 months, and they couldn't diagnose me, and I was in ICU for months, and they actually declared her an unfit mother because I was failing to thrive. Then they were told once or twice that I was expected to die, and then at the very last kind of hope at 6 months, I was eventually diagnosed with cystic fibrosis. So it was definitely hard for them, of course. And then throughout my childhood, I spent a lot of time in hospital. We soldiered on through, and my parents did an amazing job fighting for services. My mum and dad and another mother set up a charity called CF Hope Source. And they funded many multidisciplinary teams in Temple Street and Beaumont and outpatient units. So they dedicated my childhood to improving services, which they have done. I'm very grateful for it. I did spend a lot of time in hospital as a child. They always made it fun. And my whole extended family, my aunties and uncles, you know, when I then got out of hospital, it was all about getting outdoors and enjoying life. And it was never held back by it, I think. And it served me up until this very day, because I think that attitude has let me get to where I am. I moved to Sligo when I was 21 or 22, and I got a job working as a videographer for a marketing company. And I think it was my first time in an office job, working, I think, half 8 till 5, and It was hard to manage doing all my medication before work and after work, and also trying to surf and socialise and everything as a 22-year-old would want to do. And I think after 8 months, I ended up in hospital for 3 weeks with a very bad hospital admission, and it was the first time I'd been in hospital for years, and I kind of realised that the 9-to-5 wasn't going to work for me, and I quit my job whilst I was in hospital and I set up my company CP Films. And
so you were in the hospital bed and you just said
sayonara, I'm out of here. And I just decided that I was going to focus on outdoor filmmaking. And actually my first job I got was with a hiking group called Gals Gone Wild, and I made 6 videos for them. So I was out on the mountains hiking 10, 20 kilometers with camera gear. So it was a complete change, but it was so great on my health because I'm not sitting at a desk. I'm outdoors, I'm in the sea, I'm up mountains. So I think it was one of the best decisions I've ever made, really. I'd always shot in the sea with a GoPro. Like, my thesis I made in college was a documentary on long distance sea swimmers and free divers. So the idea of making a film about myself was slightly nightmarish. But it came about from a conversation I had 2 years ago from the director of the London Surf Film Festival. And they released a film fund this year. And she messaged me and she's like, remember that conversation we had? Because I was telling her about the positive impacts the ocean had on my health. She was like, I think you should submit it as the pitch. The reason I made the film was for other people who might be in a similar situation to me. As a child, I felt quite boxed in about the stereotypes and limitations that my family never put them on my life, but medical staff, teachers, it comes from a place of care, absolutely, but I felt like I was being wrapped in cotton wool. The stats and figures of my life were set out for me as a person with cystic fibrosis, you know, and I guess I just rejected that without even thinking about it. The second reason I made Salt was my lungs feel so much better when I get out of the sea because of the saline and the exercise. And I think, you know, my lifestyle around the ocean has saved me multiple hospitalizations, you know, in my 20s. When I finished filming Ebb and Flow, which was my first surf film, it was the first time I spent a few months swimming out in the ocean with my camera gear, and I was even more submerged in the water than I would be on my surfboard. My lung function test that I do, which is used to measure my health, I guess, went up to the highest it's been since I was 15. And, you know, CF is a disease that gets progressively worse with age, so the expectation is that the test results are going to go down. But I think my results went up by like 20%. And I did try to explain to my medical team the reason, and they're kind of brushed off, being kind of like, oh, you must just been doing your medicine more routinely. But it's a balance. I spend 2 hours every day doing medication as well. So it's just an added thing that I do getting into the sea, which I think has had great impacts on my health. So I have waterproof housing that I put my camera in, and then I attach it to my arm with a leash, and I wear 2 fins, and I just swim out and bob around. I feel like a seal. And yeah, I love it. It's amazing to just, because I guess even with the surfboard, you're tethered to something. So you're out there kind of completely with the waves, trying to capture the feeling of the ocean, which is what I've been trying to do since I started, to capture that feeling of what it's like to be in the Atlantic.
Muse music for that film, Salt, by Alistair Hobson. That was Alice Ward talking to Lorna Siggins. You can see the film at festivals, excuse me, but it's also, this is important, going to be available online for CF Ireland members from February 20th. More details of that, cfireland.ie. 0870 32 32 32. Opinion is divided, not on whether there should be a cull of the Sika deer, but what to do with the meat. Siobhan Glennon says, morning, Philip. Very interesting to hear the report about the culling of Sika deer. I think if venison was available on a butcher's counter, people would have an opportunity to try it. It is a very lean and tasty meat. Not so, says Shona Mota. Venison in Ireland isn't great. Bloody strips of rubbish, not matured, expensive grizzle offcuts, often unpalatable. Do you know what I would say? As a very average cook, slow cooking a meat like venison turns every average cook into actually quite a good cook. Angela, very enthusiastic supporter of the cull, she says, hello Countrywide, deer have eaten our apple trees and broken our fences all around our house. The deer are very big around us. We need the population reduced. I'd say this one will run and run for a while yet. That is all that we have time for today, though. Amandine Passo Devine pronked. Yes, that is the word of the day. Damien Chanel's took cover behind the neighbour's hedge, and Eileen Heron kept everybody in her crosshairs. Sinead Mooney is on the way with your playback. Ears to the Ground on TV, 7:30 on Thursday. But from all of us on the Countrywide team, until the same time next week, have a great weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.